will come, and that not far distant, when the citizens of the whole country, as well as Massachusetts, will select for their leader a freeman of the North, in preference to a slaveholder. Gaining momentum, Seward predicted the time will soon arrive when further demonstrations will be made against the institution of slavery, eventually moving public conscience to liberate all the nation's slaves. The hour was late when Lincoln was introduced, but he captivated his audience with what the Boston Courier described as a most forcible and convincing speech, which scored a series of capital hits against both Democrat Cass and Free Soiler Van Buren, whom he nicknamed the Artful Dodger of Kinderhook, referring to his frequent shifts of party and position. He concluded, amidst repeated rounds of deafening applause. Recalling Lincoln's rambling, storytelling speech more than two decades later, Seward agreed that it put the audience in good humor, but he pointedly noted that it avoided any extended discussion of the slavery question. The next night, Seward and Lincoln shared the same room in a Worcester hotel. "We spent the greater part of the night talking," Seward remembered years later, "I insisting that the time had come for sharp definition of opinion and boldness of utterance." Listening with a thoughtful air, Lincoln said, "I reckon you are right. We have got to deal with this slavery question, and got to give much more attention to it hereafter than we have been doing." While Lincoln had consistently voted for the Wilmot Proviso, he had not delivered a single speech on the issue of slavery, or initiated anything to promote the issue. As the conversation drew to a close and the two men went to sleep side by side, they must have presented a comical image. The one nearly half a foot longer and a decade younger, Seward's disorderly mass of straw-colored hair on the pillow beside Lincoln's wiry shock of black hair. Years later, as president, Lincoln recalled his trip to Massachusetts. "I went with hayseed in my hair to learn deportment in the most cultivated state in the Union." He recalled in vivid detail a dinner at the governor's house, a superb dinner, by far the finest I ever saw in my life, and the great men who were there, too. Why, I can tell you just how they were arranged at table. Whereupon he proceeded to do just that. The Whigs triumphed at the polls that November, bringing Zachary Taylor to the White House. It was to be the last national victory for the Whigs, who, 4 years later, divided on the slavery issue, would win only 4 states. To Chase's delight, Free Soiler Martin Van Buren polled more than 10% of the vote among the northern electorate, enough to prove that anti-slavery had become a force in national politics. Indeed, in several northern states, including New York, the votes for Van Buren that otherwise might have gone to the Democrats spelled victory for the Whigs. When Lincoln returned to Congress for the rump session, influenced perhaps by his encounter with Seward, he drafted a proposal for the gradual emancipation of slaves in the nation's capital, pending approval by the district's voters. Similar proposals had been attempted before, but Lincoln now added several elements. He included provisions to compensate owners for the full value of the slaves with government funds, and to allow government officials from slaveholding states to bring their servants while on government business. Finally, to mitigate the fears of southern slaveholders in surrounding states, he added a provision requiring district authorities to provide active and efficient means to arrest and deliver up to their owners all fugitive slaves escaping into said district. It was this last provision that prompted abolitionist Wendell Phillips to castigate him as that slave hound from Illinois. Through long and careful conversations with dozens of fellow Whigs, Lincoln thought he had devised a reasonable compromise that could gain the support of both moderates in the South and the strong anti-slavery wing in the North. Yet once the proposal was distributed, Lincoln found that his support had evaporated. Increasingly bitter divisiveness had eclipsed any possibility of compromise. Zealous anti-slavery men objected to both the fugitive slave provision and the idea of compensating owners in any way, while Southerners argued that abolishing slavery in the district would open the door to abolishing slavery in the country at large. Disappointed, but realistic in his appraisal of the situation, Lincoln never introduced his bill. "Finding that I was abandoned by my former backers, and having little personal influence," he said, "I dropped the matter, knowing it was useless to prosecute the business at that time." His congressional term, ending in March 1849, Lincoln campaigned vigorously for a presidential appointment as Commissioner of the Land Office, the highest office that would go to Illinois. On the strength of his services to the Taylor campaign, he believed he deserved the position. As commissioner, he would be responsible for deciding how to distribute all the public lands in the state. The office was awarded to another. It was just as well that Abraham Lincoln was not appointed. His strengths were those of the public leader, not the bureaucratic manager. "If I have one vice," he later quipped, "and I can call it nothing else, it is not to be able to say no." He then smiled and added, "Thank God for not making me a woman, but if he had, I suppose he would have made me just as ugly as he did, and no one would ever have tempted me." Before he returned to Springfield, the former flatboatman applied to patent a method of lifting boats over shoals and bars by means of inflatable, buoyant chambers. Unfortunately, no analogous device existed to refloat a political career run aground. His securely Whig congressional district had turned Democratic, a shift many Whigs blamed on Lincoln's criticisms of the war. He was out of office, with little immediate prospect of return. Assessing his brief congressional tenure, there was little to celebrate. His term, John Nicolay wrote, added practically nothing to his reputation. He had been a diligent congressman, making nearly all the roll calls and serving his party faithfully, but his efforts to distinguish himself, to make a mark, had failed. All these disappointments notwithstanding, Lincoln had forged relationships and impressed men who would contribute significantly to his future success, including Caleb Smith of Indiana and Joshua Giddings of Ohio, Westerners whose political careers were similar to his. Born in Boston, Caleb Smith had migrated west as a young man, ending up in Indiana, where he read law, was admitted to the bar, and entered politics as a Whig. He was a handsome, trimly built man, with a smooth, oval face. Despite a lisp, his power on the stump was celebrated far and wide. It was said that he could make you feel the blood tingling through your veins to your finger ends and all the way up your spine. Indeed, one contemporary observer considered Smith a more compelling public speaker than Lincoln. Later, at the 1860 Republican Convention, Smith would help swing the Indiana delegation to Lincoln, a move that would lay the foundation for Lincoln's presidential nomination. Joshua Giddings had faced obstacles as formidable as Lincoln. He had left his family and small farming community in Ashtabula County, Ohio, to study law in the town of Canfield, Ohio. His decision stunned his friends and neighbors. He had lived with them from childhood and toiled with them in the fields, his son-in-law, George Julian, observed. He had never enjoyed the means of obtaining even a common school education, and they regarded his course as the effect of a vain desire to defeat the designs of Providence, according to which they believed that people born in humble life should be content with their lot. 14 years older than Lincoln, Giddings was first elected to Congress in 1838. Re-elected continuously after that, he threw himself at once into John Quincy Adams's valiant struggle over the right of Congress to receive anti-slavery petitions. While Giddings was decidedly more militant on the slavery issue than Lincoln, the two became close friends. Boarding together at Mrs. Spriggs's house in Carroll Row on Capitol Hill, they shared hundreds of meals, conversations, and stories. So much did Giddings like and respect Lincoln that 7 years later, in 1855, when Lincoln ran for the Senate, Giddings proclaimed that he would walk clear to Illinois to help elect him. Among Lincoln's Whig colleagues was Alexander Stevens of Georgia, later Vice President of the Confederate States. Transfixed by Stevens's eloquent speaking style, Lincoln wrote a friend that a little, slim, pale-faced, consumptive man has just concluded the very best speech of an hour's length I ever heard. My old, withered, dry eyes are full of tears yet. Lincoln was not yet 40. Many years later, the classically educated Stevens recalled, Mr. Lincoln was careful as to his manners, awkward in his speech, but was possessed of a very strong, clear, and vigorous mind. He always attracted the riveted attention of the House when he spoke. His manner of speech, as well as thought, was original. His anecdotes were always exceedingly apt and pointed, and socially, he always kept his company in a roar of laughter. Lincoln's ability to win the respect of others, to earn their trust and even devotion, would prove essential in his rise to power. There was something mysterious in his persona that led countless men, even old adversaries, to feel bound to him in admiration. Taking up his law practice once more, Lincoln began to feel, he later remarked, that he was losing interest in politics. The likely reality was that his position on the Mexican War had temporarily closed the door to political office. Furthermore, this withdrawal from office was never complete. He worked to secure political posts for fellow Illinoisans, and joined in a call for a convention to reorganize the Whig Party. Through his lengthy eulogies for several Whig leaders, he spoke out on national issues, referring to slavery as the one great question of the day. And he never missed an opportunity to criticize Stephen Douglas, now a leading national figure. In the interim, he resolved to work at the law with greater earnestness. His Springfield practice flourished, providing a steady income. Mary was able to enlarge their home, hire additional help with the household chores, and entertain more freely. These years should have been happy ones for Mary, but death intervened to crush her spirits. In the summer after Lincoln returned from Washington, Mary's father died during a cholera epidemic. He was only 58 at the time, still vigorous and actively involved in politics. In fact, he was running for a seat in the Kentucky Senate when he succumbed to the epidemic. 6 months later, Eliza Parker, Mary's beloved maternal grandmother, died in Lexington. To this grandmother, the 6-year-old Mary had turned for love and consolation when her mother died. February 1st, 1850, brought Mary's most terrible loss, the death of her second son, 3-year-old Eddie, from pulmonary tuberculosis. That destiny had branded her for misery became her conviction. For 7 weeks, Mary had worked to arrest the high fever and racking cough that accompanied the relentless disease. Despite her ministrations, Eddie declined until he fell into unconsciousness and died early on the morning of the 1st. Neighbors recall hearing Mary's inconsolable weeping. For days she remained in her bed, refusing to eat, unable to stop crying. Only Lincoln, though despairing himself, was able to reach her. "Eat, Mary," he begged her, "for we must live." Finally, Mary found some solace in long conversations with the pastor of the First Presbyterian Church, James Smith, who had conducted the funeral service for Eddie. So comforting was the pastor's faith in an eternal life after death that Mary was moved to join his congregation and renew her religious faith. A grateful Lincoln rented a family pew at the First Presbyterian and occasionally accompanied Mary to church, though he remained unable to share her thought that Eddie awaited their reunion in some afterlife. Though Mary became pregnant again a month after Eddie's death, giving birth to a third son, William Wallace, in December 1850, and a fourth son, Thomas, in April 1853, Eddie's death left an indelible scar on her psyche, deepening her mood swings, magnifying her weaknesses, and increasing her fears. Tales of her erratic behavior began to circulate, stories of hysterical outbursts against her husband, rumors that she chased him through the yard with a knife, drove him from the house with a broomstick, smashed his head with a chunk of wood. Though the outbursts generally subsided as swiftly as they had begun, her instability and violent episodes unquestionably caused great upheavals in the family life. When Mary fell into one of these moods, Lincoln developed what one neighbor called a protective deafness, which doubtless exasperated her fury. Instead of engaging Mary directly, he would lose himself in thought, quietly leave the room, or take the children for a walk. If the discord continued, he would head to the state library or his office, where he would occasionally remain through the night until the emotional storm had ceased. Had his marriage been happier, Lincoln's friends believed, he would have been satisfied as a country lawyer. Had he married a woman of more angelic temperament, Springfield lawyer Milton Hay speculated, he doubtless would have remained at home more and been less inclined to mingle with people outside. Though a tranquil domestic union might have made Lincoln a happier man, the supposition that he would have been a contented homebody, like Edward Bates, belies everything we know of Lincoln's fierce ambition and extraordinary drive. An ambition that drove him to devour books in every spare moment, memorize his father's stories in order to captivate his friends, study law late into the night after a full day's work, and run for office at the age of 23. Indeed, long before his political career even took shape, he had been determined to win the veneration of his fellow men by rendering himself worthy of their esteem. Even as Lincoln focused his attention on the law, he was simply waiting for events to turn, waiting for the right time to re-enter public life. If Lincoln's ambitions appeared to have stalled, the careers of Seward and Chase gathered new momentum. Zachary Taylor's triumph at the polls created a Whig majority in the New York State legislature for the first time in many years. Because U.S. senators at the time were elected by state legislatures rather than by popular vote, Thurlow Weed focused his magic on the legislature to propel Seward into the U.S. Senate. His task was complicated by the division of the state's Whig Party into two distinct factions. Millard Fillmore, bolstered by his election as vice president, led the conservative wing, composed of merchants, capitalists, and cotton manufacturers who preferred to defuse the slavery issue. Weed and Seward represented the liberal wing. Weed's difficulties were compounded when New York papers reported a fiery speech Seward delivered in Cleveland, putting him at odds with the more moderate stance of the new administration. "There are two antagonistical elements of society in America," Seward had proclaimed, "freedom and slavery. Freedom is in harmony with our system of government and with the spirit of the age, and is therefore passive and quiescent. Slavery is in conflict with that system, with justice, and with humanity, and is therefore organized, defensive, active, and perpetually aggressive. Free labor, he said, demands universal suffrage and the widespread diffusion of knowledge. The slave-based system, by contrast, cherishes ignorance because it is the only security for oppression. Sectional conflict, Seward warned, would inevitably arise from these two intrinsically different economic systems, which were producing dangerously divergent cultures, values, and assumptions. Seward stood before his Cleveland audience and called for the abolition of the black codes that prevented blacks from voting, sitting on juries, or holding office in Ohio. Slavery, he conceded, was once the sin of all the states. We in New York are guilty of slavery still, by withholding the right of suffrage from the race we have emancipated. You in Ohio are guilty in the same way, by a system of black laws still more aristocratic and odious. Seward's support that day for the black vote, black presence on juries, and black office holding was startlingly radical for a mainstream politician. Even a full decade later, during his debates with Stephen Douglas, Abraham Lincoln would maintain that he had never been in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry. Although the difference in their positions was due largely to the contrasting political environments of the more progressive New York and the conservative, southern-leaning Illinois, Seward was more willing than Lincoln to employ language designed to ignite the emotions of particular crowds, tailoring his rhetoric to suit the convictions of his immediate audience. Knowing that his audience in the Western Reserve was likely far more progressive than many Eastern audiences, Seward ventured further toward abolitionism than he had in the past. Even so, the Cleveland Plain Dealer charged, Seward fell short of the anti-slavery zeal that put the Reserve a decade ahead of the East Coast. Nor did Seward stop with his condemnation of the black laws. He proceeded to deliver a powerful attack against the Fugitive Slave Law, written, he claimed, in violation of divine law. He brought his speech to a close with a stirring appeal intended to rouse his audience to act. Can nothing be done for freedom because the public conscience is inert? Yes, much can be done. Everything can be done. Slavery can be limited to its present bounds. It can be ameliorated. It can be and must be abolished, and you and I can and must do it. Seward's speech worried Weed. Though he agreed that slavery was a political crime and a national curse, a great moral and political evil, he predicted that this question of slavery, when it becomes a matter of political controversy, will shake, if not unsettle, the foundations of our government. It is too fearful and too mighty in all its bearings and consequences to be recklessly mixed up in our partisan conflicts. At a time when professed abolitionists remained an unpopular minority, subjected in some northern cities to physical assault, Weed warned Seward that his provocative language would place him in the same camp with extremist figures such as William Lloyd Garrison and Wendell Phillips. Seward weighed Weed's concerns, acknowledging that the emancipation issue had not fully ripened. In the weeks that followed, he muted his stridency on slavery, allowing Weed the space necessary to carry his protege to the next level. Weed ingratiated Seward with the legislators, one by one. He rounded up the liberals and assured the moderates that when Seward talked about slavery, he wanted to level society up, not down. Furthermore, he promised the Taylor administration that Seward would loyally follow the moderate party line. Despite the split in the party and Fillmore's rising star, Weed managed to corral a majority and send his friend Seward to the Senate. Probably no man ever yet appeared for the first time in Congress so widely known and so warmly appreciated, declared the New York Tribune after his election. Seward arrived with an aura of celebrity, even notoriety. Yet Weed proved correct when he anticipated that Seward's radical speech in Cleveland would come back to haunt him. Not long after the young New Yorker was sworn into the Senate, a Southern senator rose from his seat and read aloud the peroration in which Seward told his audience that slavery can and must be abolished. It was said that a shudder ran through the chamber. "If we ever find you in Georgia," one letter writer warned Seward, "you will forfeit your odious neck." Salmon Chase's bid for success through a viable anti-slavery party came to fruition in 1849. 13 Free Soilers had been elected to the 72-member Ohio State Legislature, which would choose the next U.S. Senator. Neither the Whigs nor the Democrats had a controlling majority, which gave the tiny Free Soil bloc enormous leverage. Though many assumed that former Whig Joshua Giddings, who had championed the anti-slavery cause in Congress for more than a decade, had earned the right to be considered the front-runner, Chase managed to gain the seat for himself. Ironically, his winning tactics in pursuit of this goal would shadow his career and ultimately bring him the lasting enmity of many important figures in his own state. Most of the Free Soilers were former Whigs who would not vote with the Democrats. They favored Giddings. Two independents, meanwhile, vacillated. Dr. Norton Townsend, once a Democrat, who had been a member of the Liberty Party, and John F. Morse, formerly a conscience Whig. The decisions of these two men would prove pivotal. Working behind the scenes, Chase drafted a deal with Samuel Medary, the boss of the Democratic Party in Ohio. If Chase delivered Townsend and Morse to the Democrats, Medary would see to it that Chase became the new U.S. Senator. In addition, the Democrats would vote to repeal the black laws, a condition Morse insisted upon before he would agree to the deal. In return, the Democrats would have the House speakership and control of the extensive patronage that office enjoyed. For Medary, control of the state was far more important than naming a senator. Chase worked ceaselessly to deliver Townsend and Morse to the Democrats. While Giddings remained in Washington, Chase journeyed to Columbus and took a room at the Neal House, close to the state capitol, so he could attend Free Soil caucuses at night and negotiate with individual Democrats during the day. He planted articles in key newspapers, praising not only himself, but Townsend and Morse. He lent money to more than one paper, and when the needs of the Free Soil Weekly, the Columbus Daily Standard, exceeded his means, he reassured its editor, "After the senatorial election, whether the choice falls on me or another, I can act more efficiently, and you may rely on me." He advanced money to the Standard, and later agreed to a loan, but refused to take a mortgage on the newspaper as security, because he did not want his name publicly connected, which could not be avoided in case of a mortgage to myself. Knowing that Morse was introducing a bill to establish separate schools for blacks, Chase enlisted the editor of the Standard to help get it passed. "It is really important," he urged, "and if it can be got through with the help of Democratic votes, we'll do a great deal of good to the cause generally, and our friend Morse especially." Certainly it would do a great deal of good for the career of Salmon Chase, who sanctimoniously told Morse that the only consideration in determining the next senator should be ability to best advance the cause. "Everything but sacrifice of principle for the cause, and nothing for men except as instruments of the cause." Advancement of self and advancement of the cause were intertwined in Chase's mind. In Chase's mind, both were served when Morse and Townsend voted with the Democrats to organize the legislature, and the victorious Medarie swung his new Democratic majority to Chase for senator. The unusual circumstances of Chase's election provoked negative comment in the press. "Every act of his was subsidiary to his own ambition," charged the Ohio State Journal. "He talked of the interests of free soil. He meant his own." This judgment by a hostile paper was perhaps unduly harsh, for the deal with the Democrats did indeed end up promoting the free soil cause. As Medarie had promised, the Democrats voted to repeal the hated black laws. And when Chase reached the Senate, he would become a stalwart leader in the anti-slavery cause. Nonetheless, fallout from Chase's Senate election eventually found its way into the widely circulated pages of Horace Greeley's New York Tribune. Editorializing on the machinations involved, Greeley declared that he did not see how men who desire to maintain a decent reputation can countenance or profit by it. Indeed, the suspicions and mistrust engendered by the peculiar circumstances of the Senate election would never be wholly erased. It lost to him at once and forever the confidence of every Whig of middle age in Ohio, a fellow politician observed. Its shadow never wholly dispelled, always fell upon him, and hovered near and darkened his pathway at the critical places in his political afterlife. The Whigs, and their later counterparts, the Republicans, would deny Chase the united support of the Ohio delegation so vital to his hopes for the presidential nomination in 1860. And Chase, for his part, would never forgive them. Showing little intuitive sense of how others might view his maneuvering, Chase failed to appreciate that with each party shift, he betrayed old associates and made lifelong enemies. Certainly his willingness to sever bonds and forge new alliances, though at times courageous and visionary, was out of step with the political custom of the times. Though troubled by the criticism attending his election, Chase was thrilled with his victory. So was Charles Sumner, who would join Chase 2 years later in the Senate by way of a similar alliance between free soilers and independent Democrats in Massachusetts. "I can hardly believe it," Sumner wrote. "It does seem to me that this is the beginning of the end. Your election must influence all the great West. Still more, your presence in the Senate will give an unprecedented impulse to the discussion of our cause." When Chase took his seat in the handsome Senate chamber in March 1849, nearly 20 years had elapsed since his early days as a poor teacher living on the margins of the city's social whirl. Now, as a renowned political organizer, prominent lawyer, and fabled anti-slavery crusader, Chase could claim a place in the first tier of Washington society. William Wirt would have been proud. For a brief moment, Chase's relentless need to be first wherever I may be was sated. As the 1840s drew to a close, William Henry Seward and Salmon P. Chase had moved toward the summit of political power in the United States Senate. Edward Bates, though spending most of his days at his country home with his ever-growing family, had become a widely respected national figure, considered a top prospect for a variety of high political posts. Abraham Lincoln, by contrast, was practicing law, regaling his fellow lawyers on the circuit with an endless stream of anecdotes, and reflecting, with silent absorption, on the great issues of the day. Chapter 5. The Turbulent Fifties. The America of 1850 was a largely rural nation of about 23 million people, in which politics and public issues, at every level of government, were of consuming interest. Citizen participation in public life far exceeded that of later years. Nearly three-fourths of those eligible to vote participated in the two presidential elections of the decade. The principal weapon of political combatants was the speech. A gift for oratory was the key to success in politics. Even as a child, Lincoln had honed his skills by addressing his companions from a tree stump. Speeches on important occasions were exhaustively researched and closely reasoned, often lasting 3 or 4 hours. There was demagoguery, of course, but there were also metaphors and references to literature and classical history, and occasionally, as with some of Lincoln's speeches, a lasting literary glory. The issues and declamations of politics were carried to the people by newspapers, the media of the time. The great majority of papers were highly partisan. Editors and publishers, as the careers of Thurlow Weed and Horace Greeley illustrate, were often powerful political figures. Newspapers in the 19th century, author Charles Ingersoll observed, were the daily fare of nearly every meal in almost every family, so cheap and common that, like air and water, its uses are undervalued. "Look into the morning trains," Ralph Waldo Emerson marveled, "which carry the businessmen into the city to their shops, counting rooms, workyards, and warehouses." Into every car the newsboy unfolds his magical sheets. Tuppence a head his bread of knowledge costs, and instantly the entire rectangular assembly, fresh from their breakfast, are bending as one man to their second breakfast. A European tourist was amazed at the central role newspapers played in the life of the new nation. You meet newspaper readers everywhere, and in the evening the whole city knows what lay 24 hours ago on newswriters' desks. The few who cannot read can hear news discussed or read aloud in ale and oyster houses. 17 years before the decade had begun, President Andrew Jackson had prophesied, "The nullifiers in the South intend to blow up a storm on the slave question. Be assured these men would do any act to destroy this Union and form a Southern Confederacy bounded north by the Potomac River." And now the storm had come. The slavery issue had been a source of division between North and South from the beginning of the nation. That difference was embodied in the Constitution itself, which provided that a slave would be counted as 3/5 of a person for purposes of congressional representation, and which imposed an obligation to surrender fugitive slaves to their lawful masters. Although slavery was not named in the Constitution, it was, as anti-slavery Congressman John Quincy Adams said, written in the bond, which meant that he, like everyone else, must faithfully perform its obligations. The constitutional compromise that protected slavery in states where it already existed did not apply to newly acquired territories. Thus, every expansion of the nation reignited the divisive issue. The Missouri Compromise had provided a temporary solution for nearly 3 decades. But when Congress was called upon to decide the fate of the new territories acquired in the Mexican War, the stage was set for the renewal of the national debate. "If, by your legislation, you seek to drive us from the territories of California and New Mexico, purchased by the common blood and treasure of the whole people," Robert Toombs of Georgia warned, "I am for disunion." Mississippi called for a convention of Southern states to meet in Nashville for the defense of Southern rights. The issue of slavery could no longer be put aside. It would dominate the debates in Congress. As Thomas Hart Benton once colorfully observed, "We read in Holy Writ that a certain people were cursed by the plague of frogs, and that the plague was everywhere. You could not look upon the table, but there were frogs. You could not sit down at the banquet, but there were frogs. You could not go to the bridal couch and lift the sheets, but there were frogs." A similar affliction infested national discourse as every other topic was subsumed by slavery. We can see nothing, touch nothing, have no measures proposed without having this pestilence thrust before us. Here it is, this black question, forever on the table, on the nuptial couch, everywhere. Of course, slavery was not the only issue that divided the sections. The South opposed protective tariffs designed to foster northern manufacturing, and fought against using the national resources for internal improvements in northern transportation. But issues like these, however hard fought, were subject to political accommodation. Slavery was not. We must concern ourselves with what is, and slavery exists, said John Randolph of Virginia early in the century. Slavery is, to us, a question of life and death. By the 1850s, Randolph's observation had come to fruition. The peculiar institution now permeated every aspect of Southern society, economically, politically, and socially. For a minority in the North, on the other hand, slavery represented a profoundly disturbing moral issue. For many more Northerners, the expansion of slavery into the territories threatened the triumph of the free labor movement. Events of the 1850s would put these antagonistical elements on a collision course. It is a great mistake, warned John Calhoun in 1850, to suppose that disunion can be effected by a single blow. The cords which bind these states together in one common union are far too numerous and powerful for that. Disunion must be the work of time. It is only through long process that the cords can be snapped until the whole fabric falls asunder. Already the agitation of the slavery question has snapped some of the most important. If these common cords continue to rupture, he predicted, nothing will be left to hold the states together except force. The spiritual cords of union, the great religious denominations, had already been fractured along sectional lines. The national political parties, the political cords of union, would be next, splintered in the struggle between those who wished to extend slavery and those who resisted its expansion. Early in the decade, the National Whig Party, hopelessly divided on slavery, would begin to diminish and then disappear as a national force. The National Democratic Party, beset by defections from Free Soil Democrats, would steadily lose ground, fragmenting beyond repair by the end of the decade. The ties that bound the Union were not simply institutions, but a less tangible sense of nationhood, shared pride in the achievements of the revolutionary generation, a sense of mutual interests and common aspirations for the future. The chronicle of the 1850s is, at bottom, a narrative of the increasing strain placed upon these cords, their gradual fraying, and their final rupture. Abraham Lincoln would correctly prophesy that a house divided against itself could not stand. By the end of the decade, as Calhoun had warned, only force would be left to sustain the Union. Was this outcome inevitable? It is not a question that can be answered in the abstract. We must begin with the historical realities and ask if the same actors, with the same convictions, emotions, and passions, could have behaved differently. Possibly, but all we can know for certain is that they felt what they felt, believed as they believed, and did as they would do. And so, they moved the country inexorably towards civil war. As the 31st Congress opened, the rancorous discord boiled to the surface. All eyes turned to the 73-year-old Henry Clay, who, Lincoln later said, was regarded by all as the man for a crisis. Henry Clay had saved the Union once before. Now, 30 years after the Missouri Compromise, the Congress and nation looked to him once again. Already Clay suffered from the tuberculosis that would take his life 2 years later. He could not even manage the stairs leading up to the Senate chamber. Nonetheless, when he took the floor to introduce the cluster of resolutions that would become known as the Compromise of 1850, he mustered, the New York Tribune marveled, the spirit and the fire of youth. He began by admitting he had never been so anxious facing his colleagues, for he believed the country stood at the edge of the precipice. He beseeched his colleagues to halt before the fearful and disastrous leap is taken in the yawning abyss below, which will inevitably lead to certain and irretrievable destruction. He prophesied that dissolution would bring a war so furious, so bloody, so implacable, and so exterminating that it would be marked forever in the pages of history. To avoid catastrophe, a compromise must be reached. His first resolution called for admitting the state of California immediately, leaving the decision regarding the status of slavery within its borders to California's new state legislature. As it was widely known that a majority of Californians wished to prohibit slavery entirely, this resolution favored the North. He then proposed dividing the remainder of the Mexican accession into two territories, New Mexico and Utah, with no restrictions on slavery, a provision that favored the South. He called for an end to the slave trade within the boundaries of the national capital, but called on Congress to strengthen the old fugitive slave law of 1793 to facilitate the recapture of runaway slaves. Fugitives would be denied a jury trial, commissioners would adjudicate claims, and federal marshals would be empowered to draft citizens to hunt down escapees. Clay recognized that the compromise resolutions demanded far greater concessions from the North than he had asked from the slave states, but he appealed to the North to sustain the Union. Northern objections to slavery were based on ideology and sentiment, rather than on the Southern concerns with property, social intercourse, habit, safety, and life itself. The North had nothing tangible to lose. Finally, he implored God that if the direful and sad event of the dissolution of the Union shall happen, I may not survive to behold the sad and heart-rending spectacle. This prayer was answered. He died 2 years later, nearly a decade before the Civil War began. Francis Seward was in the overcrowded gallery on February 5, 1850, when Henry Clay rose from his desk to speak. She had come to Washington to help her husband get settled in a spacious three-story brick house on the north side of F Street. "He is a charming orator," Francis confessed to her sister. "I have never heard but one more impressive speaker, and that is our Henry. Don't say this to anybody." But Clay was mistaken, she claimed, if he believed the wound between North and South could be sutured by his persuasive charm. Though he might make dough faces out of half the Congress, his arguments had not convinced her. Most upsetting was Clay's claim that Northern men were only activated by policy and party spirits. Now, if Henry Clay has lived to be 70 years old and still thinks slavery is opposed only from such motives, I can only say he knows much less of human nature than I supposed. 4 weeks later, the galleries were once again filled to hear South Carolina's John Calhoun speak. Although unsteady in his walk and enveloped in flannels to ward off the chill of pneumonia that had plagued him all winter, the 67-year-old arch-defender of states' rights appeared in the Senate with the text of the speech he intended to deliver. He rose with great difficulty from his chair, and then, recognizing that he was too weak to speak, handed his remarks to his friend, Senator James Mason of Virginia, to read. The speech was an uncompromising diatribe against the North. Calhoun warned that secession was the sole option unless the North conceded the Southern right to bring slavery into every section of the new territories, stopped agitating the slave question, and consented to a constitutional provision restoring the balance of power between the two regions. Making much the same argument he had utilized in the early debates surrounding the Wilmot Proviso, he warned that additional free states would tilt the power in the Senate, as well as in the House of Representatives, and destroy the equilibrium between the two sections in the government as it stood when the Constitution was ratified. This final address to the Senate concluded, Calhoun retired to his boarding house, where he would die before the month was out. Daniel Webster of Massachusetts, the third of the Great Triumvirate, as Clay, Calhoun, and Webster were called, was scheduled to speak on the 7th of March. The Senate chamber was crammed with more men and women, a Washington newspaper reported, than on any previous occasion. Anticipation soared with the rumor that Webster had decided, against the fervent hopes of his overwhelmingly anti-slavery constituents, to support Clay's southern-leaning compromise. Francis Seward was watching when the senator rose. "I wish to speak today, not as a Massachusetts man, nor as a northern man, but as an American," Webster began. "I speak today for the preservation of the Union. Hear me for my cause." He proceeded to stun many in the North by castigating abolitionists, vowing never to support the Wilmot Proviso, and coming out in favor of every one of Clay's resolutions, including the provision to strengthen the hateful fugitive slave law. Many in New England found Webster's new stand particularly abhorrent. "Mr. Webster has deliberately taken out his name from all the files of honor," Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote. "He has undone all that he spent his years in doing." Frances found the speech greatly disappointing. "The word compromise," she told her sister, "is becoming hateful to me." Acknowledging that Webster was a forcible speaker, particularly when he extolled the Union, she found him much less eloquent than Henry Clay, because his heart is decidedly colder. People must have feeling themselves to touch others. Despite such criticisms, the speech won nationwide approval from moderates, who desperately wanted a peaceful settlement of the situation. A few anti-slavery Whigs expressed a fear that Seward might hesitate when the time came to deliver his own speech, scheduled 3 days later. "How little they know his nature," Francis wrote. "Every concession of Mr. Webster to Southern principles only makes Henry advocate more strongly the cause which he thinks just." Francis was right. Anti-slavery advocates had no need to worry about her husband. For weeks, Seward had been working hard on his maiden address to the Senate, delivered on March 11, 1850. He had talked at length with Weed and rehearsed various drafts before Francis. The capital of the 1850s offered no private office space, so Seward wrote at home, rising early in the morning and working long past the midnight hour. As he began his Senate oration, Seward spoke somewhat hesitantly. Reading from his manuscript, without dramatic gestures, he quoted Machiavelli, Montesquieu, and the ancient philosophers, in a voice so low that it seemed he was talking to himself rather than addressing the chamber and the galleries. His words were so powerful, however, that Webster was riveted, while John Calhoun, attending one of his final sessions in the chamber, was restless at first, but soon sat still. Seward began by maintaining flatly that he was opposed to compromise in any and all the forms in which it has been proposed. He refused to strengthen the fugitive slave law. "We are not slaveholders. We cannot be either true Christians or real freemen," he continued, "if we impose on another a chain that we defy all human power to fasten on ourselves." He declared that a ban on the slave trade in the district was insufficient. Slavery itself must be abolished in the capital. Finally, staunchly affirming the Wilmot Proviso, he refused to accept the introduction of slavery anywhere in the new territories. As he moved into the second hour of his speech, his conviction gave him ease and confidence. Step by step, he laid the foundation for the higher law doctrine that would be forever associated with his name. Not only did the Constitution bind the American people to goals incompatible with slavery, he asserted, but there is a higher law than the Constitution, which regulates our authority over the domain and devotes it to the same noble purposes. The territory is a part of the common heritage of mankind, bestowed upon them by the Creator of the universe. We are His stewards. With this single speech, his first national address, Seward became the principal anti-slavery voice in the Senate. Tens of thousands of copies of the speech were printed and distributed throughout the North. The New York Tribune predicted that it would awaken the nation, that his words would live longer, be read with a more hearty admiration, and exert a more potential and pervading influence on the national mind and character than any other speech of the session. Arriving on the national scene at this same dramatic moment, Chase expected to take a leading role in the fight. He, too, labored over his speech for weeks, poring through old statute books and exchanging ideas with fellow crusader Charles Sumner. The bond between Chase and Sumner would continue to grow through the years, providing both men with emotional support in the face of the condemnation they suffered due to their strong anti-slavery views. "I find no man so congenial to me as yourself," Chase confided in Sumner. For his part, Sumner considered Chase a tower of strength, whose election to the Senate would confirm the irresolute, quicken the indolent, and confound the trimmers. "I cannot disguise the deep interest with which I watch your movements," Sumner wrote Chase shortly before he was to give his speech. "I count confidently upon an exposition of our cause, which will toll throughout the country." When Chase took the floor on March 26th, for the first part of his five-hour address, however, Seward had already delivered the celebrated address that outlined most of the positions Chase intended to take, and had instantly made the fiery New Yorker the foremost national voice among the anti-slavery forces. Nor did Chase possess Seward's compelling speaking style. If, over the years, constant practice had improved his range and delivery, he was unable to eradicate the slight lisp that remained from his boyhood days. Although his arguments were thoughtful and well-reasoned, the chamber emptied long before he finished speaking. Writing home, he admitted great disappointment with the result, which was infinitely below my own standards, and fell below those of my friends, who expected much. "You know I am not a rousing speaker at best," he conceded in a letter to a friend. He wanted it understood, however, that the speech was delivered under very great disadvantages. The first chapter of the celebrated Benton Foot confrontation, which so engaged the attention of everybody, occurred on the very same day, so that I had hardly any chance of attention, and in fact received not much. Chase was referring to a dramatic argument that broke out on the Senate floor between Senator Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri and Senator Henry Foote of Mississippi. Benton had called Foote a coward, leading Foote to recall an earlier histrionic incident when Benton himself had behaved in cowardly fashion. In response to this personal attack, Benton rose from his chair and rushed forward menacingly. Foote retreated behind a desk and then drew and cocked a pistol. "I disdain to carry arms," Benton shouted. "Let him fire. Stand out of the way and let the assassin fire." The melodrama was finally brought to a peaceful close when Foote was persuaded to hand over his pistol to a fellow senator, and Benton returned to his chair. Chase's disappointment over his failure was compounded by Sumner's praise for Seward's compelling maiden effort, which, Sumner told Chase, had filled him with gratitude. "Seward is with us," Sumner exulted. "You mistake when you say Seward is with us," Chase replied, with a heat not unmixed with resentment. "While Seward holds many of our anti-slavery opinions," he continued, "his loyalty to the Whig Party made him untrustworthy. I have never been able to establish much sympathy between us," he explained in a follow-up letter. "He is too much of a politician for me." Over the course of the previous decade, Seward and Chase had maintained a dialogue on the most effective methods to promote the anti-slavery cause. Despite their divergent views on whether or not to join a third party, Chase had always held Seward in the highest esteem and looked forward to working with him on anti-slavery issues in the Senate. The alteration in his attitude was likely spurred by jealousy, an emotion the introspective Chase begrudged in others, yet could never subdue in himself. "I made this resolution today," he had confided in his diary when he was 23 years old. "I will try to excel in all things. Yet if I am excelled, without fault of mine, I will not be mortified. I will not withhold from anyone the praise which I think his due, nor will I allow myself to envy another's praise, or to feel jealousy when I hear him praised. May God help me to keep it." His best intentions, however, could not assuage the invidious envy that possessed him at the realization that, given an identical opportunity, Seward had emerged the acclaimed leader of the anti-slavery forces. A rift developed between the two men that would last long into the Lincoln administration, with far-reaching consequences for the country. Even as Seward basked in the applause of the anti-slavery community, however, he found himself excoriated in both Southern editorials and conservative papers throughout the North. "Senator Seward is against all compromise," the New York Herald observed. "So are the Negroes of New York. His views are those of the extreme fanatics of the North, looking forward to the utter destruction of the institutions of the South." Seward was initially untroubled by such criticism from expected sources, and remained convinced he had spoken words that will tell when I am dead. Frances had never been prouder of her husband. When she looked at him, she told her sister, she felt almost overwhelmed by her love and respect for him. Such elation was soon tempered by a disquieting letter from Weed, who feared that Seward had overreached when enunciating a higher law than the Constitution. Though Weed had seen earlier versions, he had not read the final draft. "Your speech sent me to bed with a heavy heart," Weed confessed to Seward. "A restless night and an anxious day have not relieved my apprehensions." Weed's criticism distressed Seward, who recognized that his mentor's political instincts were usually better than his own. Indeed, the implications of Weed's critical letter left Seward sunk in despondency, covered with sorrow and shame, apprehensive that he had jeopardized not only his own career, but that of his mentor as well. Seward's status was further shaken when President Zachary Taylor, who had admitted both Weed and Seward to his inner circle, developed a fatal gastronomical illness after attending 4th of July festivities on the grounds of the unfinished Washington Monument. Taylor's sudden death brought Seward's conservative rival, Millard Fillmore, into the presidency. With Fillmore in the White House, the anti-slavery contingent had no prospect of stopping the compromise. Under the skillful leadership of Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas, Clay's omnibus bill was broken up into a series of separate pieces of legislation, which passed in both the House and Senate in September. The Compromise of 1850 seemed to end the crisis. Stephen Douglas regarded the bill as a final settlement, urging his colleagues on both sides to stop the debate and drop the subject. Upon its passage, the leading hotels in the capital were illuminated, and a salute of 100 guns was sounded. Serenaders, accompanied by a large crowd of spectators, honored Clay, Webster, and Douglas, singing Hail Columbia and the Star-Spangled Banner under the windows of their residences. The joy of everyone seemed unbounded, the New York Tribune noted. The southern-leaning Lewis Cass exulted, "The crisis is past, the cloud is gone." While the nation hailed the compromise, however, a Georgia editor warned prophetically, "The elements of that contest are yet all alive, and they are destined yet to outlive the government. There is a feud between the North and the South, which may be smothered, but never overcome." In Springfield, tracing the unfolding drama in the newspapers, Abraham Lincoln appeared to be satisfied that a peaceful solution had been reached. While he was unhappy about the provision bolstering the fugitive slave law, he understood, he later said, that devotion to the Union rightfully inclined men to yield somewhat in points where nothing could have so inclined them. Rejecting Seward's concept of a higher law, he preferred to rest his own opposition to slavery in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. During the relative calm that followed the passage of the Compromise, Lincoln rode the legal circuit, a pursuit that proved congenial to his personality as well as his finances. He relished the convivial life he shared with the lawyers who battled one another fiercely during the day, only to gather as friends in the taverns at night. The arrival of the judge and lawyers generally created a stir in each town on their circuit. Villagers traveled from miles around, anticipating the courtroom drama as hundreds of small cases were tried, ranging from disputed wills, divorce, and bastardy proceedings, to slander and libel suits, from patent challenges and collection of debts to murder and robbery. "The local belles came in to see and be seen," fellow circuit rider Henry Whitney recalled, "and the courthouse from early morn till dewy eve, and the tavern from dewy eve to early morn, were replete with bustle, business, energy, hilarity, novelty, irony, sarcasm, excitement, and eloquence." In some villages, the boarding houses were clean and comfortable, and the food was excellent. In others, there were plenty of bedbugs, and the dirt was half an inch thick. The lawyers generally slept two to a bed, with three or four beds in a room. While most of the traveling bar regularly bemoaned the living conditions, Lincoln savored the rollicking life on the circuit. He was singularly good at his work, earning the respect and admiration of his fellow lawyers. Several of these associates became great friends and supporters, among them Circuit Judge David Davis. In letters to his wife, Sarah, Davis spoke not only of Lincoln's exceptional skill in addressing juries, but of his warm-hearted nature and his exceeding honesty and fairness. Davis had come to Illinois from Maryland when he was 21, after graduating from Kenyon College and New Haven Law School. In his late 20s, he was elected to the state legislature and considered a career in politics, but his wife, whom he loved too well to thwart her views, was vehemently opposed. Instead, he ran for circuit judge, a position that offered the camaraderie of the circuit 6 months a year, yet enabled him to devote sufficient energy to business ventures that he eventually accumulated a substantial fortune. The evolution of a warm and intimate friendship with Lincoln is evident in the judge's letters home. The two men took lazy strolls along the river, shared accommodations in various villages, read books in common, and enjoyed long conversations on the rides from one county to the next. No lawyer on the circuit was better loved than Lincoln, a fellow lawyer recalled. He arrogated to himself no superiority over anyone, not even the most obscure member of the bar. He was remarkably gentle with young lawyers. No young lawyer ever practiced in the courts with Mr. Lincoln, who did not in all his after life have a regard for him akin to personal affection. At mealtimes, all those with an interest in the various cases at hand would eat together at the same long table. Judge Davis would preside, surrounded by the lawyers, the members of the jury, the witnesses, the bailiffs, and the prisoners out on bail. Once the meal was done, everyone would gather before the blazing fire or in Judge Davis's quarters to talk, drink, smoke, and share stories. Though Lincoln did not drink, smoke tobacco, use profane language, or engage in games of chance, he never condescended to those who did. On the contrary, when he had addressed the Springfield Temperance Society at the height of the Temperance Crusade, he had insisted that such of us as have never fallen victims have been spared more from the absence of appetite than from any mental or moral superiority over those who have. No sooner had everyone settled in than the call would come for Lincoln to take center stage. Standing with his back to the fire, he juggled one tale after another, Herndon recalled, keeping his audience in full laugh till near daylight. His eyes would sparkle with fun, one old-timer remembered, and when he had reached the point in his narrative which invariably evoked the laughter of the crowd, nobody's enjoyment was greater than his. One of Lincoln's favorite anecdotes sprang from the early days just after the Revolution. Shortly after the peace was signed, the story began, the Revolutionary War hero Ethan Allen had occasion to visit England, where he was subjected to considerable teasing banter. The British would make fun of the Americans, and General Washington in particular, and one day they got a picture of General Washington and displayed it prominently in the outhouse, so Mr. Allen could not miss it. When he made no mention of it, they finally asked him if he had seen the Washington picture. Mr. Allen said he thought that it was a very appropriate place for an Englishman to keep it. Why, they asked. For, said Mr. Allen, there is nothing that will make an Englishman shit so quick as the sight of General Washington. Another story, relayed years later by John Usher, centered on a man who had a great veneration for revolutionary relics. Learning that an old woman still possessed a dress that she had worn in the Revolutionary War, he traveled to her house and asked to see it. She took the dress from a bureau and handed it to him. He was so excited that he brought the dress to his lips and kissed it. The practical old lady rather resented such foolishness over an old piece of wearing apparel, and she said, "Stranger, if you want to kiss something old, you had better kiss my ass. It is 16 years older than that dress." But Lincoln's stories provided more than mere amusement. Drawn from his own experiences and the curiosities reported by others, they frequently provided maxims or proverbs that usefully connected to the lives of his listeners. Lincoln possessed an extraordinary ability to convey practical wisdom in the form of humorous tales his listeners could remember and repeat. This process of repetition is central to the oral tradition. Indeed, Walter Benjamin, in his essay on the storyteller's art, suggests that repetition is the nature of the web in which the gift of storytelling is cradled. Would we do nothing but listen to Lincoln's stories? Whitney was asked. Oh, yes, we frequently talked philosophy, politics, political economy, metaphysics, and men. In short, our subjects of conversation ranged through the universe of thought and experience. Years later, Whitney recalled a lengthy discussion about George Washington. The question for debate was whether the first president was perfect, or whether, being human, he was fallible. According to Whitney, Lincoln thought there was merit in retaining the notion of a Washington without blemish that they had all been taught as children. It makes human nature better to believe that one human being was perfect, Lincoln argued, that human perfection is possible. When the court closed on Saturday afternoons, most of the lawyers traveled home to rejoin their families, returning on Sunday night or Monday morning. Davis later recalled that Lincoln was the exception to the rule, often remaining on the circuit throughout the weekend. At first, they all wondered at it, Davis said, but they soon learned to account for his strange disinclination to go home. While most of us had pleasant, inviting homes to return to, Lincoln did not. With the traveling bar, Lincoln was as happy as he could be, and happy no other place. Herndon agreed, arguing that Lincoln stayed on the circuit as long as he could, because his home was hell. Absence from home was his heaven. Such withering commentary on Lincoln's marriage and home life was made years afterward, when both Davis and Herndon had developed a deep hostility to Mary. The letters Davis wrote to Sarah at the time reveal quite a different story. Lincoln speaks very affectionately of his wife and children, Davis told Sarah in 1851. On other occasions, Davis described a letter Lincoln had received from Mary reporting nursing troubles with Willie, and a conversation in which Lincoln had confided that both he and Mary were hoping for a girl before Tad was born. Nothing in these letters hint that Davis detected marital discord in the Lincoln home. The specter of some domestic hell is not necessary to justify Lincoln's devotion to his law career. Life on the circuit provided Lincoln the time and space he needed to remedy the want of education he regretted all his life. During his nights and weekends on the circuit, in the absence of domestic interruptions, he taught himself geometry, carefully working out propositions and theorems, until he could proudly claim that he had nearly mastered the 6 books of Euclid. His first law partner, John Stewart, recalled that he read hard works, was philosophical, logical, mathematical, never read generally. Herndon describes finding him one day so deeply absorbed in study he scarcely looked up when I entered. Surrounded by a quantity of blank paper, large heavy sheets, a compass, a rule, numerous pencils, several bottles of ink of various colors, and a profusion of stationery, Lincoln was apparently struggling with a calculation of some magnitude, for scattered about were sheet after sheet of paper covered with an unusual array of figures. When Herndon inquired what he was doing, he announced that he was trying to solve the difficult problem of squaring the circle. To this insoluble task, posed by the ancients over 4,000 years earlier, he devoted the better part of the succeeding 2 days, almost to the point of exhaustion. In addition to geometry, Lincoln's solitary researches allowed him to study the astronomy, political economy, and philosophy that his fellow lawyers had learned in college. Life was to him a school, fellow circuit rider Leonard Swett observed, and he was always studying and mastering every subject which came before him. Lincoln's time on the circuit was certainly difficult for Mary. His long absences from home were one of the greatest hardships of their marriage. For Lincoln, circuit life was invaluable, Beyond the congeniality of boarding house life and the opportunity to continue his lifelong education, these travels provided the chance to walk the streets in dozens of small towns, eat at local taverns in remote corners of the state, and gain a first-hand knowledge of the desires, fears, and hopes of thousands of ordinary people in Illinois. The people who would become his loyal base of support in the years ahead, when the time came to return to his first love, politics. While Lincoln was productively engaged on the circuit, Seward was dispirited by what he perceived as a reactionary turn in the country's mood. "If I muzzle not my mouth on the subject of slavery," he wrote Francis, "I shall be set down as a disturber, seeking to disturb the Whig administration and derange the Whig party." Responding to the public mood, he muted his strident voice on slavery and turned his attention to the less controversial issues of education, internal improvements, and foreign policy. Progress on emancipation, he endeavored to convince himself, could come only with the gradual enlightenment of the American public. When both Henry Clay and Daniel Webster died in 1852, he delivered such glowing eulogies on the Senate floor that his more radical friends took offense. "They cannot see," Seward complained to Francis, "how much of the misery of human life is derived from the indulgence of wrath." The idealistic Francis accepted her husband's rationale for the eulogies, but could not countenance his reluctance to resist the reactionary zeal that enveloped the country after the compromise. When it appeared that the 1852 Whig convention was on the verge of endorsing the compromise in an attempt to create a moderate platform for its presidential candidate, General Winfield Scott, Frances begged her husband to come home. "I do not wish you to be held responsible for the doings of that convention if they are to endorse the compromise in any manner or degree," she wrote. "It will be a sad disappointment to men who are true to liberty." Nor did she spare him whenever she detected a blatantly conciliatory tone in his speeches or writings. While she conceded that worldly wisdom certainly does impel a person to swim with the tide, and if they can judge unerringly which way the tide runs, may bring them to port, she continued to argue for a more elevated course that would reconcile one to struggling against the current, if necessary. In Charles Sumner, Frances found a politician who consistently chose the elevated course she favored, even though he was often isolated as a result. Sumner, a bachelor, who, like Chase, was said to look like a statesman, with imperious, well-chiseled features, would often dine with the Sewards when Frances was in town. When she returned to Auburn, they kept up a rich correspondence. Sumner valued her unflagging confidence, particularly during his early days in the Senate, when his unyielding position on slavery provoked anger and ridicule. Though his attempt to repeal the Fugitive Slave Act in August 1852 garnered only 4 votes in the Senate, not including Seward's, who, like other anti-slavery men, refused to support it on the grounds that it would torpedo Scott's chances for the presidency, Frances stood loyally by her friend. "This fearless defense of freedom must silence those cavillers who doubted your sincerity," she wrote. "It is a noble plea for a righteous cause." That November, when the Southerners' candidate, Franklin Pierce, crushed Scott in what Northern Whigs considered a Waterloo defeat, Frances fell into a state of despair. Her confidence in the mainstream political system gone, she was tempted, she told her husband, to join the abolitionists. Seward persuaded her to hold back, arguing that it would do more harm than good if the Seward name were attached to the abolitionist cause. Try as he might, Seward could not persuade Frances to stay with him for more than a few months at a time in Washington. Her decision to remain in upstate New York, especially in the wretched summer months, was not unusual, but even when the weather began to cool as autumn set in, Francis remained in Auburn. "Would that I were nearer to you," he lamented from Washington on his 54th birthday, but he accepted that his widened spheres of obligation and duty prevented him from realizing his wishes. Had Francis Seward enjoyed good health, the course of their marriage might have been different. Everywhere Seward went, he rented sumptuous homes, hopeful that she and the children might join him. Burdened with a fragile constitution, Francis was increasingly debilitated by a wide range of nervous disorders. Nausea, temporary blindness, insomnia, migraines, mysterious pains in her muscles and joints, crying spells, and sustained bouts of depression. A flashing light, a bumpy carriage ride, or a piercing sound was often sufficient to send her to bed. As her health deteriorated, she found it more and more difficult to leave her sanctuary in Auburn, where she was attended by her solicitous extended family.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.